Well, thank you, Peter, and all of you for your welcome. It's good to be back. I was here a little while ago, and it's very good to be back amongst you. I think we owe them an explanation from that cryptic comment about Psalm 91. Peter said that he was going to intersperse the singing with verses from Psalm 91. Oh, I said, I have a bit of a problem with Psalm 91, which was his comment. It's a fantastic psalm in places. It's an incredibly difficult psalm in others. Some years ago, I was involved with Tear Fund, and I went with the international director to Central America just a few, two or three months after Hurricane Mitch. And we were in Guatemala, and we went to a place where a great side of a mountain had collapsed following the hurricane. And in that landslide, two whole villages had been caught up and had been washed away. That morning, Jenny and I had read Psalm number 91 together. Wonderful psalm. He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. You will fear not the terror of night. Many of you know those verses. Those two villages were both strongly evangelical villages. They were both full of love for the Lord. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. And that later on that day, we looked into the faces of a couple who had left the village the day before the landslide to go and look for work and had returned to find everything and everybody gone. We read it again that night with tears running down our faces. And I can never go through that psalm without thinking of that day. So that was the comment that I made to Peter. So there we go. And some great song choices. I didn't know them all. I thought I did by the titles, but I didn't know them all. But I enjoyed them. Thank you, Peter. Now, as he mentioned, I'm preaching from the lectionary. Now, I know that isn't something that regularly happens here, but in many churches, particularly Anglican churches, Methodist churches, preachers follow a lectionary, which is a group of Bible readings set out for each Sunday following a theme. They will go through a gospel, or they will go through a passage, an epistle or whatever. And I don't know who selects them, but they are selected on a 3-year cycle. As preachers, we're not obliged to follow them, but in many ways it gives us a framework to base our services on, unless we sense that the Lord has put something specific on our hearts. And within the Methodist Church, perhaps more so than here, we have a variety of preachers. So it does give some continuity, as well as different ideas. So today there was Psalm 91. There was the gospel reading about the rich man and the poor man at his gate, a whole conversation about heaven and hell. So I looked at that one and thought, is that the one I should talk about? Or shall we look at Timothy, which is very much to do about money? It was quite a challenging choice to know which to choose from. But anyhow, we're going with Timothy. This is Paul's first letter to Timothy. And it's one of four letters written by Paul to individuals rather than churches, rather than the Church of Rome, Romans, the Church of Corinth, the Corinthians. And he wrote two letters to Timothy, one to Titus and one to Philemon. And they are known collectively as the pastoral letters. And these letters deal with the care and the organization of the flock of God. They tell people how to behave within the household of God. They give instructions as to how God's church should be administered. as what sort of people the leaders and pastors should be. Some very strict instructions. And how the threats which endanger the purity of the Christian church, remember it was very much in its early birthing days, how the threats to its faith and life should be dealt with. So they're very practical letters. You could say they have a theological base, but they are very practical, full of instructions. So who was Timothy? He was a native of Lystra, which was a Roman colony in Galatia, which is, of course, where a church was. And we have the book of Galatians. And I looked it up, and that was in what is now the northeast area of Turkey. It was a little place at the end of the civilized earth, and there was a Roman garrison there which kept control over the wild tribes to the east. There seemed to be wild tribes to the east of Turkey, even to this day. And it was visited by Paul and Barnabas on their first missionary journey. And at that point, there was no mention of Timothy, who must have been very young, because he's a very young man. But it's been suggested that when Paul and Barnabas arrived in Lystra, they may well have had lodgings in Timothy's home, as Paul knew very well the faith of both his mother, Eunice, and his grandmother, Lydia. But when Paul went to Lystra again on his second missionary journey, we read this in Acts 16. He came to Derbe and then to Lystra, where a disciple named Timothy lived, whose mother was a Jewish and a believer, but whose father was Greek. I don't know whether he was a believer as well. I feel rather sorry for his father, the way it's just, he was a Greek. The believers at Lystra and Iconium spoke well of him. Paul wanted to take him along on the journey, so he circumcised him because of the Jews who lived in that area, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. So he was a child of a mixed marriage, and although Paul was in no way a slave to the law, he obviously felt it was expedient that if Timothy was to be accepted by Jewish people to whom the message of Jesus was to be preached, he should be circumcised. We throw away a comment when in Rome, but in many ways we have to be mindful of that, to be aware of the context in which we are. To Paul, Timothy seemed the very man to be his assistant, and we read of him numerous times throughout Paul's writings and throughout the book of Acts. Timothy was constantly by Paul's side, and when Paul had a difficult job to do, Timothy was the man to do it. He was very fond of Timothy, speaking of him with great affection. And when he travelled over to Macedonia, he left Timothy back in Ephesus. And in his letters to the church in Philippi, he writes in glowing terms these words: I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon, that I also may be cheered when I receive news about you. I have no one else like him who takes a genuine interest in your welfare. For all are looking out for their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know that Timothy has proved himself because, as a son with his father, he has served me with me in the work of the gospel. So I hope, therefore, to send him as soon as I see how things go with me. Now, at the very beginning of the letter to Timothy, which we read from chapter 6, Paul writes this: Timothy, my son, I give you this instruction in keeping with the prophecies once made about you, so that by following them you may fight the good fight, holding on to faith and good conscience. Some have rejected these, and so have shipwrecked their faith. So there was obviously trouble at Mill, so to speak. And it's interesting when you read, particularly through this first letter to Timothy, how many phrases or verses we've hung on to. and that we know, even if we're not sure where they come from. All that is background to the passage that Margaret read earlier. There's a great deal, as I say, in these letters, some of it quite difficult to read in our day and age. So perhaps I could turn to chapter 3, verse 4. This is talking about leaders in the church. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him with proper respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? Many years ago, a very, very good friend of ours in our house group led wonderful work with the young people. But he gave it up because he could not get that verse out of his mind. And his children, young adults, were not leading the sort of life that he felt they should. Very challenging verse. Now, I just go a few verses above that. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or have authority over a man. She must be silent. Perhaps even more controversial. But women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety. We have to read these verses in context of when they were written. Some people find them more challenging than others. Some of us just look at them and move on. And at that point, I'll have a little drink. It's all quite challenging. But I want to turn our attention to a few key points in this reading and see what they say to us. And the first sentence contains, "But godliness with contentment is great gain." Godliness with contentment is great gain. And the word to consider is contentment. I looked up about this verse. And the Greek word, you can tell that I had to look it up. I have absolutely no idea about grief apart from alpha, beta, gamma, delta. And that's as far as I get. But the Greek word, and apologies for anybody who knows how to pronounce it, is autarkia. Is that right, Jenny? Oh, I thought you might know. That's very reassuring. And it means a complete self-sufficiency, by which is meant a frame of mind which was completely independent of all outward things and which carried the secret of happiness within itself. For many of us, that might seem hard to achieve, though we get the gist of it. We understand true contentment does not come from the possession of external things which so easily be taken from us. Surely it comes from an inward attitude to life. Now, it's very easy to say that if you're doing all right. Don't misunderstand me. Poverty is a terrible, terrible thing, made all the worse by the excesses that so many of us, yes, even us, have in our lives. The imbalance of the wealth distribution in our land, let alone throughout the world, is a huge indictment on us all. And it's not that Christianity pleads for poverty. There is no special virtue in being poor or in having a constant struggle to make ends meet. Surely that is totally against the teachings of the man who said that he is the bread of life. But Christianity does believe that it is never in the power of things to bring true happiness. E.K. Simpson wrote, "Many a millionaire, after choking his soul with gold dust, has died from melancholia." I like that word, melancholia. We don't say it very often. We know that to be true. Remember the story Jesus told of the farmer who had a bumper harvest and didn't know what to do with it. It never occurred to him to share it. So he built bigger and better barns and stored all his grains. And he said to himself, you've all that you want. Eat, drink, and enjoy yourself. But God said, you fool. This very night you will have to give up your life. What good is it to you then? Some of the people in Timothy's charge were obviously subscribers to what is known in this day and age as the prosperity gospel. In verse 5, we read, constant friction between people of corrupt mind who've been robbed of the truth and who think that godliness is a means to financial gain. The idea that if you're a Christian, God will automatically bless you with wealth is, in my opinion, and I'm sure yours, an abhorrence. True contentment has precious little to do with what we have, though I grant you that to be on the poverty line must make it so much harder. But we know full well that some of the poorest in the world, who have of necessity to live very simple lives, are far more content than their rich neighbours. And many today, right across the spectrum, are recognising that money does not automatically bring contentment and are looking for ways to make their lives more simple. Another key phrase, which is surely one of the most misquoted in the Bible, and this is the second thing I want to look at, is in verse 10. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. How many times we hear, well, money is the root of all evil. Not true. The love of money is the root. William Barclay wrote, money in itself is neither good nor bad, but the love of it may lead to evil. With it, we may selfishly serve our own desires. With it, we may answer the cry of our neighbor's need. With it, we may facilitate the path of doing wrong. With it, we may make it easier for someone else to live as God meant them to do. Money is not in itself an evil, but it is a great responsibility. It is powerful to good and powerful to evil. Many years ago, in the same house group that I mentioned about Peter earlier, we studied a book written by Richard Foster called Money, Sex and Power. It was a big thing back in the day. And we thought we'd get through this fairly quickly. We spent week after week after week on money. We had no idea of how significant it was in our lives. Sex and power, well, forget those. Money was the thing that was the challenging thing. Very interesting. I want to show you a picture. This, for me, is more than just a picture. It's a very powerful image. Despite many, many failures on my part, I would say that these hands describe how I try to live my life. The way I see it, everything, whether it's money, family, material possessions, health, opportunity, the list goes on and on, have been given by God. And even those intrinsic things like character, the strengths and weaknesses of my life, I brought nothing to the party. Everything has been given to me, to you. We come with empty hands. It's so easy for us to begin to think of any of the above as ours. Not mine, as mine. It's insidious. But this image for me reminds me over and over again that they're not mine. Whatever God has placed in my hands, he has placed into open hands, If our hands are open, he can place whatever he wants into them, and he can easily take them away. Maybe they're given for a season or for a long time. But God placed them there. I don't own them. You don't own them. However hard we've worked for them, however much we think of them as our right, we don't own them. And it certainly helps to get the perspective right. Because as soon as my fingers begin to clench, as of course they do, things get out of kilter. An example. We have four children, and for many years they all four lived overseas, the nearest in Dubai. So they were scattered. And many people would say, I don't know how you manage, I don't know how. And often they would hold their hand like this. And it sounds all very, I don't know, sanctimonious if you like. But I would say, we hold them with an open hand. They are free to come and go. We don't own them. It makes it so much easier. And as an aside, but equally as important, you remember that wonderful verse in Isaiah, I have written their name on the palm of my hand. And I would sometimes, when I was feeling a bit motherish and a bit miserable, I would think of their names written on God's hand, thinking, and my name too, our names. We weren't so far away after all, on an open hand. In the middle of this talk, all about money and possessions, and some people think this little section has been inserted in, whether it has or not, I don't know. In the middle of all this, Paul urges Timothy to flee, pursue, fight, and take hold. Christian life is not passive. As it is, as Paul points out from verse 11, but you, man of God, flee from all of this. All of this business about money. And pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance and gentleness. Fight the good fight of the faith. Take hold of the eternal life to which you were called when you made your good confession in the presence of many witnesses. All very active verbs. One of the questions for your discussion in the week is about these Christian characteristics. So look out for that one. We are to replace the chase for money with the chase for holiness. If only I spent as much time chasing God as I do flicking through catalogues to see if there's anything interesting coming up, or wondering about this, or watching a program about nice houses, or whatever it happens to be. Jesus said a great deal about money and possessions. He knew how much of a temptation and diversion they could be. And as I say, there are many in society looking for a simpler lifestyle, looking for something that they've not found in the busyness of modern working lives. But we know where our treasure should be. As Jesus says in Matthew's Gospel, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And in Luke chapter 12, there's a warning. From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. That has sat heavily on my shoulders for many, many years. But true contentment, true happiness, as we say, as Jesus knew, is to be found in banking our treasure in heaven. Not just time every now and again, from time to time, but every day as we focus on eternal perspectives, which will therefore transform our daily perspectives.